6. Duality. McAfee spent a lot of his time talking about women. Indeed, he had had more women in his life than perhaps anyone I've ever known, and to that extent it was easy enough to imagine that some of the internet rumours that suggested he'd fathered over 30 children in his life could well be true. I wanted to talk to him about women some more and his relationship with them over the adult years, but before I did, he started the next call telling me that he was late because he'd just got off the phone with, coincidentally, a woman, Deanna Lorraine, a former YouTube host and relationship coach, who also happened to be running as a Republican congresswoman in California's 12th district. As much as I always wanted to keep McAfee on track, sometimes it was simply impossible. In any case, I'd come to realize that some of his most insightful thinking came not just when I prompted him, but also when he just felt like it. To that end, when these detours arose, I more than often let him run. Me. Why did this politician call you? John McAfee. She wanted to know if she could use my name privately as one of her supporters. So I said yes, because I don't give a shit who I endorse. If somebody wants to say John McAfee is a supporter of mine, why would I care? Not long ago, I also contacted Andrew Yang and told him that I'd like to throw my support behind him for the presidential campaign. I plan to do the same thing with everyone, because why not? And then I thought, if I'm doing this for presidential candidates, why not also for congressmen or women? I, a presidential candidate myself, am happy to throw my weight behind Deanna. I can't remember her surname. Me. Deanna Lorraine is her name, and some would say that she has some highly questionable views. John McAfee. Her name doesn't really matter because, generally speaking, none of these people matter. I don't give a shit about her views either, good God. Me. What do you mean? John McAfee. In my mind, they might as well be automatons. In fact, they are automatons, to the extent that you can predict exactly what they're going to say and do. They are like computer programs in the sense that if you input certain commands, you will get the same responses every time. Therefore, it does not matter who sits on a chair in any official office. In America, that chair has essentially been a vacant office since the late 1950s anyway. They might as well grab some random street vermin who doesn't speak or write and put him in that goddamn chair for 4 years. It wouldn't make any difference. Me. I take it you are cynical about politicians, presidents generally. Isn't that ironic, given you've tried to be one? John McAfee. Let's call it what it is. That chair has been occupied by a set of profoundly charismatic and articulate actors that have all simply pretended that they play on the same team as the rest of us poor schmucks. Me. Does that sentiment not apply to every politician anywhere? John McAfee. I don't want to come over as being cynical about every aspect of life, so what about Mahatma Gandhi as the exception? Can we talk about him for a second? What part of anything he ever did was self-serving? But that's the only one I know. Of course, there is a possibility that he too was merely a shadow created by the media. But there were also too many eyewitness accounts of his actions in the role of a servant, whatever company he was in, for that mirage to be the case. If that was acting, then fuck me, that was an interesting play and one that I'd like to watch again. If it wasn't, then the man just loved people and life, and he just wanted people and life to be better, so that the world in which he lived would become a better place. I would elect a million of those men long before I'd elect anyone who pays $100 million to land a goddamn job. Me. But technically, you fall into that latter category. How do you square that away? John McAfee. As I've told you, I'm not going to be president, and nobody is going to elect me to anything. I'm just making a point that anybody can do it. Me. Before we continue with the story, I want to talk to you about women, again, generally, because it's such a big part of your life, and I have to confess to not really understanding your motivations on that front. Also, you've just told me, out of the blue, that you got married, while at the same time telling me that you can't be faithful. John McAfee. My life with women always followed a certain pattern. As I told you, Alexa was my first great love when I was a teenager. Then our paths kept crossing thereafter. And then from her, the first time I went to a woman called Karen, when I was a freshman in college. She was older than me, more experienced sexually than me, and I liked that. While I was with her, everyone else was excluded. Where my apartment near the campus would normally be full of people, booze, and women, that all changed while I was with Karen. Eventually, I got tired of Karen, and then all my friends came back, and it was a free-for-all for a while, until I found someone new. Me, when you say it was a free-for-all, how did that play out practically? John McAfee. I might have had one new woman every day in five. Then I might have had 15 in one weekend. It wasn't as if it was a contest or anything. I just loved women and had since that first kiss in the woods. I've often described taking heroin as like being kissed by God, but that's not the case. Truly being kissed by God is when circumstances occur that you just couldn't predict the outcome. Like when I kissed that young girl in the woods I told you about. I didn't know if she'd run away or scream or hit me. She saw me coming, but she didn't run away. She was just waiting. For what, she didn't know. And when it was over, she never ever mentioned the incident to anyone, not even me. I hardly remember seeing her after that, even though she must have still been in my class for the remainder of that year. But my point is that after that experience, that adventure, I must have thought, what do I need you for? She was just an innocent victim in a monumental moment in someone else's life. A twisted moment of molestation provided a moment of enlightenment for John McAfee, and regardless of what people might think of that, I will not back away from that. Me, are you being serious when you call this molestation? You were seven. John McAfee, are you kidding? In today's America, it would be. Someone, probably both of us, would be in therapy. We are the font of political correctness. We are the shining banner for the faithful sheep. They're not going to like what I just said, but I want you to say it anyway. Me. Okay, I feel like we're getting somewhere with this. Are you then saying that all of your relationships with women over the years have simply been an attempt to recapture this feeling, and not about the women themselves? John McAfee. I don't think I was chasing the feeling, but I do think I've been chasing that doorway all my life to a degree, via a multitude of different women. Of course, at some point, I realized that I didn't actually need the women, but even then, my habituated body would still say, well, if there's nothing else happening, I want sex. And for me, that was never much work. I could call someone to come over, go to a whorehouse or a bar. I could always find sex and excitement. Me, all of this makes relationships, like the marriage you just told me you entered into in 1980 with Claire, almost impossible, right? John McAfee. Oh yes, how could I ever have success in a marriage? The problem is, I have lived two lives regarding women throughout my life. When a special woman was there, and when a special woman wasn't there. In each instance, I was two completely different people. When there was no special woman there, I was in bachelor mode and did exactly as I wanted, mostly driven by physical impulses that inevitably led, given I am a sex addict, to frequent sexual encounters. My mind, the part that says, dude, why are you even doing this, was completely disengaged. When that special woman was there, I was truly attempting to be the proper person that deserved that woman's attention. And to do that, I tried to truly understand that woman's needs, the most notable need usually being that I wouldn't go down the street and fuck somebody else. If I had to be faithful, I would absolutely do my best. During these times, I truly wanted to know these women and specifically why it was that I was with them in the first place. There had to be a fucking reason, and I always wanted to know what that reason was. Me, did you find these reasons? John McAfee, of course not. If you think you consciously know why you do shit, then I doubt you're the same species as me. If you sit and analyze the sequences of events, you'll realize that your conscious thoughts play such a tiny role in why things happen that you might as well discount them completely. Why? Because there's a big fucking world out there, with its own ideas and its own chaotic direction. We're just thrown in the middle of all that shit, and if we think that chaos gives a shit about any individual member of that pool of chaos, well, it doesn't. Me? Are you suggesting that we don't really choose anything in life, including wives? John McAfee? Do you really think I chose to be here, on the run, with a woman 35 years younger than me, who was an ex-prostitute, who has also tried to kill me? I didn't, but I am here, and we are happy and married on paper. Chaos brought us here. Chaos of some kind or another brought me into every relationship and every marriage I was ever in. Me. Based on everything that you've told me, why do you keep getting married? John McAfee. As I've alluded to already, I am basically two people. One part of me wants to conform, not to people, but to the accepted norms of the world, just so that I don't run around hurting and offending people just by being me. That's one part. The part where I say to myself, Jesus, dude, you can't do this. People are going to get hurt. Then the other part of me says, yeah, but I'm sorry. I'm just not happy living like that. And that extends into every aspect of my life. Health, spirituality, sex, relationships, and work. I have been at war with me forever. So the person that keeps getting married is that one who simply doesn't want to make any waves, right? The dude that just wants to get through a day without going to jail, being shot at, or having a woman hold a knife at my throat, which has happened more than once. The other person is the one who sees an attractive woman and says, good God, I'm aroused. And then what do? Naturally, I try to get her into bed. I do not know how to stop that impulse, or even why I should. Me. Which person is the real you? John McAfee. Both are. That's the point. Me. I think you're more self-aware than most, and to that extent, very open about your faults. John McAfee. That may be, but the thing I learned long ago is that, as much as we might want to, we cannot hide who we really are. It comes out in your actions, your words, the shifting of your eyes, and your daily choices. Please, God, you can't hide shit. That can't be hidden. Can I ask you a question? Me, of course. John McAfee. Do you think there's a book here? The reason that I'm working with you is that you are mature enough and experienced enough to understand my life. You are a mirror for me. I am using you. Me, why do you feel the need to ask? John McAfee. Well, I don't want to do something worthless that wouldn't interest anyone. I want a real book where people can actually learn something from my life. If we can do that, I'll be very happy. Me, my turn to ask a question. Do you have in the region of 39 children, as has been said in the press? John McAfee. That's a whole story in itself. I have 5 that I know about, but I have no way of knowing the number for sure. However, what I do know is that literally dozens of women have inevitably come out of the woodwork over the years claiming that I was the father of their child. That, however, does not mean that I am. Of this number, a percentage I had never even met. They could be eliminated immediately. Of the remainder, a proportion of those I'd never had sex with. They too could be discounted. Then there was a bunch of women whom I may have had sex with, but the age of the child relative to when we'd last seen each other made it impossible for me to have been the father. But the rest? Pure conjecture. Me? Let's go back. It's 1981. The boss at Booz Allen Hamilton has just fired you for a serious conflict of interest, and you've just married Claire. What next? John McAfee. We decided to try our luck and head to California. We went to Palo Alto, the center of Silicon Valley, got an apartment, and Claire started working for a well-known computer technology company. Meanwhile, I got a job working for a company called 4Phase Systems, which built smart data entry terminals back then. They wanted me to develop operating systems for them, and I did what I had always done. Turned up rarely, did a great job, but within months I got bored senseless and left. Shortly afterward, I took another job with another Silicon Valley company called Omex, which was the first company making optical memory, which facilitated, at least for those days, far greater memory capability than magnetic memory. We were barely at the beginning of the technology age. Me. From a historical perspective, how did Silicon Valley happen? John McAfee. Its origins by far predated me showing up there in 1982, let's put it that way. From my understanding, it just organically happened. San Francisco was always a mecca for the drug scene, which most techies have always belonged to, probably because of Stanford University's status as a draw for research into computer sciences dating back to the late 1960s. Then that synergy of all those techies being attracted to San Francisco probably just created a spontaneous technological revolution. From there, expansion south along El Camino Real, the street continuing 50 miles from San Francisco to San Jose as it does today, was inevitable. In 1983, it was probably 20 miles long and 5 miles wide. There were car companies, service industries, and technology. That's all there was in Silicon Valley. Me, what happened at Omex? John McAfee. On one hand, the work at Omex was some of the most technically challenging work I'd ever done. I was the director of software engineering for the company, and unlike most of my other jobs, I was in the office almost all the time. The problem was, even though my colleague, the director of hardware, was the straightest motherfucker on the planet in that he didn't smoke, drink, or take drugs, the wider culture at Omex was completely hedonistic, to the extent that people, me included, were literally snorting coke off their desks and, me included, having group sex in the conference room. It was here at Omex that my drug consumption reached an all-time high. I was absolutely out of control. One of my life's great turning points was looming on the horizon. Me. What drugs were you taking? John McAfee. Let's see. Psychedelics, mushrooms, cocaine, speed, marijuana. Whatever I could get my hands on at the time. Inevitably, my wife and I separated, and she is still in Silicon Valley now working, though I haven't talked to her for many, many years. Me. Why did you separate? John McAfee, the usual reasons, I couldn't stay faithful. At first I went from my wife, Claire, to another girlfriend briefly, and then ultimately to the woman who would end up being my third wife, Linda. I met Linda while I was still at Omex, and I did so because one of our suppliers at the time was located in New Jersey. Consequently, every now and then, I'd have to fly over to New Jersey for business meetings and to resolve technical issues, and on one occasion when I was flying back, I was getting ready to board the plane in Newark. In those days, I was into motorcycles, so I got into the habit of wearing cowboy boots because they prevented your calves from getting burned on the bike exhaust. Anyway, I was with this colleague of mine, Jeff, a crazy motherfucker who also happens to be a brilliant computer mind. We had dropped acid or some other psychedelic, and just as the airline representative was saying, "Mr. McAfee, we need to leave, can you please board the plane?" I stood up and had this sudden sensation that for the first time in my entire life, one of my legs was shorter than the other. It wasn't just a little shorter, there was a significant difference. I said to myself, "How on earth have I never noticed this?" I started taking my boots off because I just had to see this for myself. "Mr. McAfee, we have to leave," the woman working for the airline said again. "But one of my legs is shorter than the other," I kept saying. That woman was Linda. She was so sweet, even though I was clearly out of my mind on acid. Once I finally got on the plane, she gave me a nice, quiet seat up the back and then came and sat with me. By the end of the flight, I just had to ask her out. Next thing I know, we're getting married and living together in Santa Clara. The only problem was that I never actually divorced Claire. Me? Obviously that was illegal, yes? John McAfee. This will be the first time any of this has been revealed. I have never discussed any of this before, but at this point, I don't mind it being out there. In my eyes, it was so long ago that the legal aspect of it doesn't really matter. I just never got around to divorcing Claire, and in any case, she somehow went off and married someone else, so I guess it didn't really matter. Anyway, I married Linda. We would be together for 17 years thereafter. How were things at home at the beginning of your new marriage, given your drug issues? John McAfee. Rocky. I was on the edge of the precipice with drugs and alcohol at Omex. You just have no idea how insane Silicon Valley was at that time. People were making money left and right. 1 month's salary after tax could buy you a house, and a good engineer capable of writing a serviceable operating system could write their own ticket. The wider economy in America was booming at the time. Meanwhile, the demand for the technology was impossibly high while the supply was impossibly low. Why? Because this was a whole new fucking field and only we, those of us who had been in programming from the beginning, knew how to play on it. It was quite a time. At this point, it's important to say that as many drugs as there were flowing around in 1983, substances like cocaine actually had a purpose. We were all on the edge of an exciting moment for mankind. The dawning of the computer age was imminent. We needed these drugs to keep functioning for as many hours as possible so we could keep making breakthroughs. These advances were going to change the world, and they did. Nothing changed the world like computer technology. Drugs, especially stimulants, were an essential part of that. You've told me before that you have a good sense of impending doom. Did you have that sense in 1983? John McAfee. Methamphetamine's appearance in the valley changed a lot of things. Relative to cocaine, methamphetamine is a vastly superior stimulant for everything: staying awake, concentration, and coming down hard. No come down is harder than methamphetamine. So when you're working with brilliant people, half of whom are constantly wired, edgy and ragged, it eventually takes its toll. In that environment, I did what I always did and just took things to the absolute limit and beyond. I have no clue how work ever got done in that office. Perhaps as a distraction, I also got into the Bay Area sex club scene around that time. Me, what was the impetus for going down that path as a newly married man? John McAfee? Just the people who were around me. Jeff, who I mentioned earlier, was into tantric sex as well as taking all manner of drugs. He and his girlfriend were running around, sleeping with other couples and belonging to sex clubs. Meanwhile, another programmer who worked with me at Omex, Rich, was also into the San Francisco club scene, and I'd known him for several years after our paths crossed at one of my previous employers. Rich was one of the brightest men I ever met, but he was also one of the strangest. One night he said to me, "Dude, let's go to the catacombs in San Francisco. And believe me when I tell you that this place, in the 1980s, was the most experimental sex club on the whole fucking planet." He took me to a party in this huge, gothic-looking building with arched ceilings. It looked like a massive cave, and in that cave were things I'd never seen before. Me, would you say your sexual tastes were experimental at this point? John McAfee. Yes, and for two interrelated reasons. Firstly, I'd taken a lot of drugs of various kinds by 1983. Inevitably, I'd had a lot of sex while taking drugs at various times, and some of the sex I'd had while under the influence of psychedelics was indescribable. Secondly, and as a result of that, I was a sex addict. I don't say that glibly at all or to brag. It was just a fact. Therefore, I was always looking for the next sexual thrill, which meant I was liable to be tempted down extreme paths. Me, how much do drugs enhance sexual experiences for you? John McAfee, I have always used drugs with women, and it's a very important part of my life because it's a very potent part of my life. Oh my God, does it enhance the experience? I could recommend a drug for almost every sensation you want to feel while having sex. If you wanted to feel like God himself is kissing you, I could give you a drug that would let you feel that. Me, what did you see at the catacombs? John McAfee. Even by my standards, the catacombs was an extreme experience, and it was comprised of various demonstrations, one of which was Mistress Cat, a blonde dominatrix from across the bay in Oakland, who gave a demonstration with a young slave. This young slave was a guy in his early 20s, naked, tied up by the wrists, and suspended from something above, with his feet just a few inches above the ground. Mistress Cat had a whip and flagellated him as a bit of blood started running down. Then she put on a glove, which appeared to have long, sharp tacks sticking out from the palm and each individual finger, whereupon she reached under, grabbed his whole package and started to squeeze. Blood was appearing between her fingers as he attempted to pull himself up. The pain must have been indescribable, but his face wasn't one of pain. It exhibited nothing but total ecstasy. That was just an example of the kind of thing that was happening there. Another was this old man in his 70s who got naked, wrapped chains around himself before prostrating himself beneath a raised stage, in effect making himself a human step for women in high heels. He lay there all night long while women walked all over him as they were going up and down from the stage. Then there were two gay guys, one of whom was tied up with electrodes attached to his nipples. Meanwhile, the other passed the controller around to anyone who was watching. Many people cranked it up to 10 on the dial. There were hundreds of these demonstrations going on simultaneously. This was the kind of shit that Rich got me into, and it absolutely went hand in hand with the Omex lifestyle vibe. Me, I know you got sober and clean around this time. Was Omex the tipping point? John McAfee. That kind of lifestyle has a heavy price, let's just say that. And that price is not payable in money, albeit that I did eventually quit my well-paid job at Omex around this time. If I hadn't, I would have self-destructed. For me, it all came to a head one day. I felt like I was standing on a deserted street corner at night, with a cold wind blowing through a big hole in the center of my being. That's the only way I can describe how I was feeling. Me? In retrospect, do you think this feeling was the culmination of an emotional state that long predated Omex? John McAfee? Yeah. When you're in that kind of state, you always know something's not right. But instead of doing something about it, you take more drugs to see if that makes things any better. Or you might think that if you streamline what you're taking, that might change things enough. But none of these things have an effect when you reach that point on the street corner I'm describing. Me? I feel like the fact that the street is deserted and you're alone is especially symbolic. John McAfee. Oh, absolutely it is. When you reach that place, believe me, my friend, you are on your own. You certainly don't have any friends anymore. They have slipped away over time without you even noticing. There are no friends in the world of drugs. This I promise you. Me. Is that a generalization? John McAfee. Yes, it's a generalization in the sense that it applies to all drugs, including religion, which, in my mind, is a drug as bad as any other. It certainly applies to my life. Maybe nobody else has ever felt as empty and alone as I felt, so I did what everybody did back then, at least those who had the money to. I started going to shrinks. I just kept thinking, someone has to know what the fuck is wrong with me. I hired and fired about 5 of them pretty quickly. But every single one of them identified the fact that I had a serious fucking drug problem, which I didn't try to hide. They all said, stop taking drugs. Me, had you even tried prior to these shrink meetings? John McAfee, fuck yes. This is how bad it had gotten with me. I would flush all my drugs down the toilet at night, every fucking thing. Then, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd be awake and desperately looking for crumbs on the table or for any powder that might have fallen against the windowsill. Meanwhile, I'd be calling everybody I knew, and within hours, I'd have replenished everything I'd flushed down the toilet the night before. I repeated this cycle on countless occasions. The only people I had left in my life were rich and people I'd just call coke whores. Me? Were these actual whores? John McAfee? Not necessarily. This is just the general term for women who would fuck you if you had some really fine cocaine. I had plenty of those. But those weren't real friends any more than the other people who hung around me only because I had drugs were. Any sensible person had abandoned me long ago. I was left hanging out with the dregs of society. Me. Again, there's a big part of you that is drawn to that underbelly of society, true? John McAfee. Yes. Whenever I could experience the company of people I never knew existed, I did. These people fascinated me. That, in general, still applies today. If you're in town and you're that kind of person, I don't care if you're eating children. I want to have dinner with you. And if you are eating children, I definitely want to have dinner with you. So anyway, by the time I got to my 5th or 6th shrink, I was starting to get really pissed off, because none of them could fucking fix me. I was paying them good money, yet I was still taking drugs and feeling empty. As ludicrous as this might sound, I was looking at them thinking, what is your fucking problem? Finally, I met this older, jolly-looking Santa Claus type. I liked him because he smiled and was jovial. I enjoyed visiting him simply because he seemed to enjoy his job and life generally. On my 2nd visit, he said, Mr. McAfee, I can't help you, but call this number, please, and go to a meeting. He handed me a card for AA and said, this is the only help I can possibly give you. He stood up and walked out. Later, I called the number. Me. How long before you went to an actual meeting? John McAfee, I went to one that same night in Santa Cruz, even though I knew that alcohol per se wasn't exactly my problem. When I showed up at this meeting, everybody around me was warm and friendly. They looked in my eyes when they addressed me and genuinely listened when I spoke. So I sat there, and the man beside me reached over and shook my hand. How do you do, sir? That was too much for me. I got up, pretty much ran to the door, and left thinking, this shit is not for me. I was standing on the sidewalk by my car when this man came out. He put his arm around my shoulder and said, why don't you come back in? And I did. It was a speakers meeting that night where someone in the group would stand up and talk at length. This lesbian woman got up, the last person on earth I would have had anything in common with. For that half an hour that she talked, she told my story exactly, because we all have that story. Me, I understand that that's an extremely tough moment to confront. John McAfee, from that day in 1983 up until 7 years ago, I never touched any drugs or alcohol. Resisting was the hardest thing I've ever done. But after about 4 years, I felt little by way of desire to take drugs or drink. I knew I couldn't possibly slip. For the first year or two, I went to 2 AA meetings every day. In the evenings, I would go out to hospitals and mental institutions to help inmates who had issues like mine. Again, these were the people I gravitated to, and the reality was that most of them were only there because they'd fried their brains and lives on drugs and alcohol. Me? Did you connect specifically with any of these people? John McAfee. The main reason any one of them went to these meetings in these institutions was that there was always free coffee and cigarettes. You didn't get coffee in a mental institution unless you went to AA meetings, and these were just like regular AA meetings, only the people there were a little crazier. This one guy who was there told me a story about how he went off the edge on methamphetamine 3 years previously. At that point, they put him on antipsychosis drugs, which in many cases are actually worse than the drugs themselves. "I don't have any hope whatsoever for my future," he began. "Because I can't, given the drugs they are giving me, ever articulate myself well enough to ever be allowed to leave here." Basically, unless he got out of there, which he couldn't, he'd never get off these antipsychotic drugs. I really got to see some things that opened my eyes. I went to this one meeting in that first year in South San Jose, where it was basically the resident Mexican population that showed up. When there were gringos there, they held the meeting in English. When there were no gringos, they held the meetings in Spanish. I walked in there one night in 1984, and this man stood up and told a story about how he was a blackout drinker who had a tendency to get violent, and that he woke up one morning to find that his wife was gone. There was blood around the house. He didn't know what had happened. Then he found her in the garage in a garbage bag, chopped into pieces, which, as it turned out, he had himself done. He had gone to prison for that and had gotten out after so many years, and there he was with me telling his story. Me, how did that story make you feel? John McAfee, if you start hearing stories like that, well, motherfucking hell, you will start paying attention to your own life. Me, do you think these AA meetings gave you a sense of camaraderie that you had never really had? John McAfee, yes, I needed real people I could listen to and who would listen to me. Everyone in the technology business back then was a fake and was puffing up, polishing their image, smiling for the sake of smiling, and talking vacuous shit. They weren't talking about finding their own wife chopped up in garbage bags. That's a real fucking conversation, my friend. I heard some real shit at AA. Me, can you explain how AA made life more navigable for you in particular? John McAfee. Early on, I had the revelation that the addiction wasn't to a physical substance, but to a state of being. I realized for the first time in my life that we're all basically the same. We're all self-centered. I am a self-centered motherfucker, and so are you. AA didn't change that, but what it did do was promote the acceptance of that. At the time, when I accepted that fact about myself, that allowed me to accept it in everybody else. And what a major jump that is in a person's relationship with the world. We are all in the same fucking boat. We are all lost, many of us. We are alone, many of us. AA totally changed my life. But at the same time, it confined my life, because you cannot live always based on principles. There are no principles in a war, or when someone is trying to kill you, or kidnap, or abuse you. In those situations, principles go out the window. It becomes life or death. And when the shit really hit the fan and I went to AA, I realized that I didn't need principles anyway. Therefore, now I do exactly what I want with no exception. Obviously, I don't want to do things that are harmful to myself or others, but that's only because I'm still living. But if the need arises, I'm drinking. If the need arises, I promise you I'm taking methamphetamine. And the need for both has arisen on several occasions in the last 8 years. But for the rest of the time, I can take or leave both drugs and alcohol. Me. I've sensed a theme of loneliness that runs through your life. Would that be a fair comment? John McAfee. We are all alone. I don't give a shit what anyone else says. We are. If you think just by virtue of the fact that you're in a crowded auditorium that somehow you're not alone, well, you don't understand what alone really means. You are on your own, people. I don't care who is around you. However, as long as other people's goals, desires, and hopes are aligned with ours, we experience what we think are camaraderie and friendship. If at any point that alignment ceases, that so-called friendship also ceases. This I know to be a fact. It's like being on a train where everyone's cool with the destination. Nobody's dragging his or her feet because everyone just wants to get there. But when that train breaks down or gets to the other end, that's when you're going to find out who your fucking friends are. To that extent, your so-called friends are an ever-changing and oscillating set of individuals that is entirely dependent on your trajectory relative to theirs. Does that sound cynical? Me? No. But when you get there, it makes life easier, not harder, yes? John McAfee. Absolutely. It makes life perfect. It makes things like forgiveness so much easier. How could you not forgive someone who has done exactly what you would have done yourself? Please, God, let's all get real. That changes everything about how you view life. And it is also a healthy attitude for business. Having gone through every aspect of drug ingestion and the motives behind taking them, I really understood that aspect of human nature at a time when I most needed to. Me? Why do you think so many people can't face their own realities and, by extension, can't stop addictive behaviors? John McAfee. That's a great question, and I really believe that the reason is that we as humans spend a lot of time judging other human beings. That's what we do. Judging other people simply allows us to put ourselves in whatever position we want to, in terms of where we fit into the social order. Strongest, fastest, slickest, coolest, or whatever. And that becomes a fundamental part of our reality. Our perception of our place on the social scale. And we can only ever find that place by judging others. Me. But none of that is real. John McAfee. The opposite. That shit is as fake as it gets. But it's real enough in our minds that we structure our reality around it. Now, when people start looking at themselves, the first thing that they realize is that the people we hate the most, we hate because we are exactly the same. And to accept that, we must destroy our entire worldview. If we can't accept that we are the things we hate most, and that we have a roaring fire inside of us, no matter how that fucking fire manifests, we can't move forward. So for me, in 1984, I had to destroy everything about my perception of the reality I lived in. Me. On paper, that seems like a monumental achievement. John McAfee. Don't get me wrong. Everybody is capable of this. But not everybody is placed in a situation where this absolutely has to happen. If you're in a fucking jungle and bullets are flying over your head, there's not much force needed to let you see how bad your situation is. In my case, the trajectory of my life just happened to pass through this big-ass room full of mirrors. The world had put me in front of a mirror, my mirror, the mirror of John McAfee, in which I had no choice but to see myself. If I hadn't, I'd be dead. Me. What specifically did you see in that mirror? John McAfee. All the ugliness that I'd ever hated. It was me, and it was also everybody. Seeing yourself is only half the battle, though. Learning how to accept and love the part you hate is the real job, but you have to, because it's the truth of you. Me. What is the truth of you? John McAfee. Before AA, I was a divided human being. One half did not communicate with the other. Each knew the other was there, but chose to glance over and say, nah, fuck you. Until 1984, I had never acted as a whole person. If you can't accept yourself as a whole person, you sure as hell can't act like one. But now I do, in everything I do. I see my generosity and my greed. I see my love and my dislike. I see everything. As of right now, I am a gracious, compassionate, loving, generous, hopeful human being. I am also a greedy, angry, jealous, selfish human being. I am all of that simultaneously, and there is not a single word, a single act, or a single thought that I could have that does not simultaneously conclude all these things. Not only do I see everything, but I also realize that everything we call negative has a use. It is either life-supporting, life-preserving, or somehow enhances our ability to perceive, discriminate, or understand. Take anger, for example. People say it's just ugly, but I see anger as a beautiful tool that is entirely necessary. If you were to tell your kid not to touch a hot stove with his or her hand, for example, what are you going to do when he or she reaches for that stove? An angry word or phrase is going to get their fucking attention, that's for sure. Me. Many would say that religion created this division. John McAfee. Let's not blame religion entirely, please. But society as a collective, where words like schools, parents and neighbours, etc., only exist as part of that society, can only function if two things happen. One, you know who you are and that the negative parts of you are not going to hurt other people. Or you're not that whole person, and society in the form of your parents has to force you to conform by saying, this is bad, don't do that, don't do it this way. And then when you leave home, you are forced in another way by the cops who say, dude, do that, and you are going to jail. It's one of those two alternatives, and since not everyone is able to be a whole person, that's where the structure of society gives us the concept of shame, which becomes significant when the threat of punishment alone just isn't enough of a deterrent to keep people in line. Punishment and shame are what society uses to keep people in check, and it is shame that makes us divide ourselves in two. And, to circle back to your point, it is religion that is the main propagator of shame. Shame on you. Society needs religion, or something like it, to provide the shame which, in turn, keeps society orderly. However, I don't feel shame. That should be blatantly obvious to the most casual observer. I have never avoided a question for the last 35 years unless you ask me something like, hey, are you into kinky sex? In which case I'll say, none of your fucking business. I wouldn't be saying that from a place of anger either, but more from a societal perspective of telling you to get back in line. Me? Maybe this idea of acknowledging our two sides is something we are all meant to find out about life. John McAfee. I don't know what life is all about, but I do know that it's not possible to act as a whole human being, as an individual, if you don't love all of yourself, the two distinct sides of you. Beyond that, I don't think love for anyone or anything in this world is possible if you don't love yourself. For me, everything in my past that I thought was love was simply self-interest. If I loved a woman, what did that mean? Well, it meant I wanted to keep her for my own pleasure and joy. All the time I was with her, I was on cloud fucking nine. But fuck me, don't lose that bitch. That's not love. But now I actually can love people. I love the people who steal from me. It's crazy. I also love the people who don't, because they're all just me. As soon as I fell in love with myself, I fell in love with the universe because I realized I knew who I am. The dogs who come up and lick me in the street, or don't, I am them. Me. What was the next job after Omex and these days in AA? John McAfee. I'm glad we talked about how I feel about relationships. I don't think I've ever articulated it before. Anyway, yes, so I went from Omex to a job at Lockheed Martin, and at Lockheed I did exactly the same thing as I ever did, with the notable difference being that I was in the midst of attending daily AA meetings. But again, my reputation was so good, my design ethic so strong, and my code so tight that I got away with it. Nobody even bothered anymore. I told them I'd be working from home before I even took the job. While I was at Lockheed, because I was bored working from home, I started a whole bunch of businesses of my own, one of them called Voice Command, which was the first off-the-shelf voice recognition product. I ended up selling it to Interstate Voice Products for $800,000, which was a lot of money in 1984. That was my first truly entrepreneurial product in computers that made me significant money. Me. What was the progression into forming McAfee from Lockheed? John McAfee. Well, as I told you, it was during this period at Lockheed where I got pulled to the side to work on the CIA Black Program following that thorough interrogation where I told you I answered as honestly as I possibly could. The Black Program itself was unremarkable, but just like anyone else who has worked on one, I was told of the dire consequences I'd face if I ever discussed it. People might say, well, you're a fugitive now, why won't you just say what you did? My response to that would simply be that I'd like to hope that I won't always be in this position. Like I said, the work was secret but unremarkable, and it took many years until the results of the work I did became useful. Beyond that, the lines between Lockheed and my starting McAfee were extremely blurred, because, as usual, I was working from home and not from the office. I'd essentially started McAfee, or certainly started developing some of the aspects that would underpin it, while I was still supposed to be working for Lockheed. I was making more money from my side gigs than I was from my main job, and my Lockheed salary was far from insignificant by any normal standards. As usual, I just pushed the boundaries of my relationship with my employer as far as they could possibly be pushed. I was never fired from Lockheed. I'd describe my move away as more of a slow degradation. I did progressively less and less to the point where I did nothing at all. It became this absurd position whereby I was so busy with my own business that I never had time to show up at meetings for my day job and just quit.